It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here.
Join with me now in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming, we present ourselves to you in this moment. We acknowledge that life is a lot bigger than any of us, but we remember connections. We see familiar faces, smiles and hugs all around, some coffee, some cake. This feeling of being together, this feeling of community reminds us of something. Some of us come from a hectic week in which being in touch with the presence of the moment escaped us. Some of us feel fine about the week, but we still wait for the other shoe to drop. That nagging feeling that any moment, it, whatever we're attached to, whatever we so desperately want, will all go up in smoke. We let go now of all that has followed us throughout the week. We simply give it up. Our burdens, helium-filled, drift off our shoulders. We watch them as they float toward the clouds, smaller, smaller, and then suddenly, they are gone. We take a deep breath and let it all out. Another breath, another exhalation. We are nearing home. We see it just ahead. It's that place we know so well. It's safe there, comfortable. We're at home, and from home, all life's difficulties are simply the scenery of our lives, nothing more. We know the place. We recognize it when we're there, for it is from this place that compassion arises. We can't be truly home until we realize that everyone, so-called enemies, those we secretly dislike, yes, they have all come home with us. Out of this realization, help us, unnamed mystery, to walk the way fully awake, and don't let us look away, for as surely as we are witness and audience, so too the world is witness and audience to us. The mystery is within us, just as we are within the mystery. Help us then, unnamed mystery, to find our home and to find ourselves. Amen.
Talking about audiences and stages makes me more aware that I'm on one looking at one. And remembering that I think we left an announcement out today that's an embarrassing announcement to give because it's about me. There's a book signing this afternoon here from 2 to 4 this afternoon. My book finally came out. We got our copies this week, and we'll have a signing at 2 o'clock today. And then we won't be selling the books in the bookstore this morning, but we'll be selling them next Sunday. So it's $12. You can afford it. To give you some idea of the kind of big bucks that are involved in books like this, we bought 250 copies for the church. If the church sells all their copies, the church will make $1,800 on that. My royalties for those will be about $120. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. A lot of us learned that bit of Shakespeare somewhere in school, But the language is so lovely that it's easy to forget that it's also true. I doubt that any of us are aware of all the different parts we play in our lives, or all the different kinds of audiences we're playing to. The ancient Greeks had a custom I've always wished we could somehow force on a whole lot of people, I know. A custom that could make it much easier for us to keep track of who we're playing and who's playing who at any given moment. And even though it's pretty impractical, it's also pretty vivid. In ancient Greece, the plays were performed in amphitheaters, sometimes huge amphitheaters, for hundreds and hundreds of people at a time. It was a time before television monitors and microphones, and many of the people sat a long way from the stage and couldn't see the actors clearly. And so to make it easier for them, the actors sometimes carried large faces of the characters they were playing on sticks that they held in front of them. So you have an actor walking around the stage carrying the role that he's playing. It's quite an image, carrying your mask around in front of you, supersized. Can you visualize what your office would look like if everyone had to do that? Or your home, if everyone had to hold up the mask that they were playing right then, and then change it for the next mask 10 minutes later, where you would store all those masks would be a problem. Or your relationship. Or you. Sooner or later, this gets uncomfortable, doesn't it? The audiences cheered for the characters, the masks, not the actors, the characters. The actors weren't cheered for being their true selves. That wasn't the game. The audience didn't care much about that, not that audience. They were cheered for changing into the mask that they were carrying around in front of them. And we all do this. One part of playing a role is playing to an audience, and you could even say that each kind of role we play is played to a different audience. Let's look at a few of the masks that we wear and the audiences we play for. I've got several. You can think of a whole bunch more. We do this all the time. A teenaged girl in great physical shape, looking gorgeous, wearing the coolest clothes, just the right jewelry, embodying, playing the right image of a cool, attractive, sexy young woman. We see these every day. She's playing not just to an audience of all her peers, but to an audience of her peers who know the rules of this game. What clothes are cool? What hairdos are cool? What jewelry is or isn't cool? Maybe even what tattoos are cool. It's a performance. She knows it's a performance. She's trying to play it well. And when she wows her audience, she knows that too. Or an older man in a $1,000 Armani suit and a Bentley or a Rolls Royce, pick your car. Also wearing the right kind of suave look. And he's also playing a role, showing that he's won at a certain kind of game of financial, not just success, but dominance, that he's made it. He's not playing to the same audience that the girl was. He's playing to an audience of his peers, those who know that car cost a bundle, and that the mask he's holding up in front of him is the mask of a hugely successful man, the hero of that sort of play. The hostess, welcoming guests into her home, a home dripping with feng shui. A home that caresses you with subtle colors and textures, carefully and tastefully chosen furniture, and just the right sort of paintings and sculptures, making the whole house into a kind of mask, held up to show a complete mastery of a certain kind of style and class. She's not playing to the teenage girl's audience. And while the man in the Rolls Royce might be comfortable in her house, She's really playing to her peers, too, who know enough about the subtle, intricate arts of home decorating to realize just how superbly she has done it. And she warms to their appreciation, given not in applause, but sometimes in awed looks and compliments. Or the child trying to be good to please her parents, showing off good schoolwork, good artwork, wanting her parents to come see her soccer game or her middle school band concert. Probably without thinking of it, she's hoping she plays her role as a daughter well enough to, well, what, sometimes earn their love, sometimes earn their respect, sometimes just earn the feeling that she's played the role well that day. Not all the roles are pleasant. Teenage gang members, even in violent gang activities, are playing to an audience of other gang members. They wear an approved costume. You can recognize them as a member of your gang, but not the other gang. High school kids of every generation who talk about what radical individuals they are can't really be radical individuals in that group unless they dress right. You know? There's the costume of the radical individuals and the requisite tattoos and hair and the rest of it. Their costumes, their shows, we're playing to an audience. Or a preacher trying to invoke and evoke the presence of an attitude of seriousness, depth, trying to convince people he's got some kind of a handle on what's sacred and what isn't. He's also playing to an audience. And hopefully it's one larger than just the people in front of him. It's the audience, probably in his mind, of all those people he's ever known or known about who know that worship services are meant to be a combination of reverence and relevance, challenge and comfort, done with the right kind of voice, body language, and attitude. Now, I included my own role in this list because I want you to know that I don't think there's anything wrong with playing many roles to many audiences. It's not a bad thing. The audiences provide the background and the context for how we live much of our lives. Most young girls want to feel pretty, need to feel pretty, should feel pretty. They want to know that they can grow from the girl role to the woman role without feeling geeky. Those roles in the right clothes and hairstyles that they're practicing at 16 can ease them into some of the roles they'll play as women. They're not bad things. The successful businessman hardly knows how to act like a successful businessman without a sense of role, costume, stage props, attitude, so he can communicate his status to those who may not know him. He worked hard for this. You can't blame him for wanting to flaunt it some. And if you've been in homes decorated by gifted hostesses, you know it just feels great. And you've probably been among those in their audience who applauded the setting they created. It's an art. And the child, well, all children play roles, just as we all did. I had my little man role to play around my father, and a different flavored role when I wanted to impress my mother. And still different roles with my younger brother and with my friends at school and so on. It's how we build our repertoire of moves in life. We don't just move from one word to another, we often move from one role to another, and we need to know these roles. We couldn't do much in many areas without having mastered a lot of those parts that Shakespeare talked about. Some of them, with gang members, warriors, it can take on a dark, a dangerous aspect, because they also want the approval of the audience that knows just how tough guys are supposed to look and talk and act. And this often includes toughness, even indifference to the suffering they cause. And I think you're mostly glad that I try to act like a preacher when I'm up here rather than fumbling around, slurring my words, looking down at the manuscript all the time. These roles are important. It's how we do our jobs well. They matter. And we know, or we should know, that we're playing roles, that we're an actor, and we're playing an appropriate role. We're the actor, we're holding up the mask. Here's the actor, here's the mask. I can separate them. I can set the mask here and still have the actor left. We know this. We think. If we don't know the difference between the actor and the role, then we may not know the difference between who we do, what we do, and who we are. I know I hate to contradict established cultural authorities here, but I know that the movie Batman Begins says that it's not who you are deep down, it's what you do that defines you. But when you're doing what you should be doing to be defined as a decent and an honorable person, then it's about who you are deep down. Because then you're playing to a different audience than the one you're playing to when you're just fighting bad guys. Then it's not the character that matters, it's the actor. And all the costumes in the world won't help us. There's an old Jewish story. I've read many versions of this. You may have heard it with different names or different setups. About Rabbi Schwartz, who said that when he stands before his maker, he will not be asked why he was not a great surgeon like Smith, or a great scholar like Jones, or a great musician like Fritz over there. He will be asked instead whether he was the best Rabbi Schwartz that he could have been. That was his only real job. There's the distinction between the actor and the role. It's also the distinction between the B-level audience and the A-level audience. You don't want to waste your A game on a B audience. In Western religion, most people think of this ultimate audience as standing before God, standing before our Maker. And they think of God wanting them to live in a certain way, and it works. More often than not, it works. The Greeks didn't think of gods. They thought of living by the highest ideals of the culture. That was the Greek word paideia, the collective noun that meant all the highest ideals that are essential if we're going to fashion noble people. This was the sacred center for them. For the Romans also, there weren't gods that were central. The Romans spoke about living under the gaze of eternity, living as though all of the noblest people who had ever lived or would ever live are watching us and then doing only those things we would be proud to do in front of that audience. It's all the same thing. There's another story about this, a wonderful parable, collected by a man named Anthony DeMello, who was one of the very best gatherers and editors of spiritual stories from all the world's religious traditions. A woman in a coma was dying. She suddenly had the feeling that she was taken up to heaven and stood before the judgment seat. "Who are you?" a voice said to her. "I'm the wife of the mayor," she replied. "I didn't ask whose wife you are, but who you are." "I'm the mother of four children." "I didn't ask whose mother you are, but who you are." "I'm a school teacher." "I didn't ask what you did, but who you are." And so it went. No matter what she replied, she didn't seem to give a satisfactory answer to the question, "Who are you?" "I'm a Christian." "I didn't ask what your religion was. I asked who you were." "I'm the one who went to church every day and always helped the poor and needy." "I didn't ask what you did, but who you are." Evidently, she failed the examination, for she was sent back to life. When she recovered from her illness, she was determined to find out who she was. And that made all the difference. That's the distinction. It's only subtle until you see it. And then it's not subtle at all. She answered questions about who she was with answers about the role she played. She held up mask after mask after mask and was saying, "But I play all these roles well. I've spent much of my waking life in these roles. It must be who I am." But here she was playing to a different audience, a higher kind of audience, asking about the actor, not the roles, wanting a higher kind of authenticity than that of her just having been a wife, mother, teacher, Christian, and the rest of it, even though all those are important. Friday night, 2 days ago, about 75 of us watched a wonderful and very quirky movie called The Movie Hero, about a cast of characters who hadn't found the right audience to play to, and the lead character, the movie hero, who had found his audience but couldn't find the role to play to the audience. After the movie, the discussion lasted for about 45 minutes because everyone there could recognize some dimensions of their life and lives of people around them from this marvelous, very strange cast of characters. It isn't about blaming ourselves for not being perfectly noble people. We don't need any more of that. It isn't about holding up one more measuring stick that will find us failing and wanting. We don't need more of that either. It's more like using the tuning fork before the orchestra starts, finding a common pitch that comes from someplace deep in us and trying to live in that key. It's more like that. Rachel Naomi Riemann, gifted physician in San Francisco, who's written two marvelous books filled with stories about life from her wonderfully perceptive way of seeing things and about what matters most in life. And I want to share one of her stories with you. This happens to be true. It's one from her own experience. She attended the retirement dinner for a medical school faculty member while she was in medical school at Stanford. He was internationally known for his contributions to medical science. Later in the evening, she writes, a group of medical students went to speak to him and offer him our congratulations and admiration. He was gracious. One of our number asked him if he had any words for us now at the beginning of our careers, anything he thought we should know. He hesitated. But then he told us that despite his professional success and recognition, he felt he knew nothing more about life now than he had at the beginning, that he was no wiser. His face became withdrawn, even sad. "It has slipped through my fingers," he said. None of us understood what he meant, she writes. Talking about it afterwards, I attributed it to modesty. Some of the others wondered if he had at last become senile. Now, almost 35 years later, my heart goes out to him. "It has slipped through my fingers." Wearing his doctor mask, he had played to appreciative audiences his entire career. He had absolutely been a success. Only when he looked back on it, he realized that behind the mask was the actor, and it was the mask that he developed, not the actor. And only the actor, not the mask, can hold life in its hands, and it slipped through his fingers. Sometimes when people feel like personal failures, or that the world's been against them, that it slipped through their fingers, then they get bitter, and they try to poison the hopes and the dreams of others. Oh, grow up. Don't be so naive. Don't be so foolish. Only children think that way. Kind of garbage never happens. Put away those stupid fairy tales. We've all heard all these lines. There are people who delight in busting others' balloons and mocking their hopes because so often they're so empty inside, and the emptiness hurts because they never found their audience. They never found their right audience and never grew into the kind of person who could play to that audience and be proud of it. We all know cynics who tear down everything hopeful and good anyone puts forth, that use that destructive little role as an identity. It's a very lazy identity. It's so easy to be cynical. But it's the screaming lack of an adequate identity, not a real one. It's a painful cry masquerading as a self. Sometimes it's a painful and a dangerous cry from the forces of the dark side, or Lord Sauron, or Voldemort. And they played to that set of powers and the rewards they hold, and found at the end that they're hollow. How and where do you find an audience that cares whether you're true to your best self, rather than giving in to the Voldemorts, the Darth Vaders, the trolls, and the demons that are always on stage too? What if you develop talent, succeed, and identify with your success rather than your character? We were born into a world that always tilts toward life and hope, and I think our deepest challenge is to adopt that tilt toward life, that tilt toward hope, to become eager servants of the best kind of life, the life that serves and heals the life within and around us, so that we won't look back and say, it slipped through my fingers. What devastating lines those are. Where to find the kind of audience that expects the best of us? If we serve the gods of our culture, we may live to succeed, gain wealth, power, or intimidation, and seek the endorsement of our society as a sign that we've won the rat race. There should be a big sign like that, a certificate you can put on the wall. I think most of us do that, at least in part, and it mostly works, at least in part. But as that great American philosopher, Lily Tomlin, said, even if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. Even if you win at an inadequate game, is it enough? If you please an audience of rats or functionaries or repressed or unhappy people, is it enough? When you stand before the mirror at those times of your life when honesty invades and makes the rules, and you have to take account of yourself, it won't matter a great deal whether you played this or that role well. It'll matter whether you were the best you possible, not what you imitated well. It will matter whether you played yourself well. And the only audience finally worth playing to is the audience that believes there is something precious and singular in you that needs to be offered to the world because no one else can do it. You're the only person in the world with the unique combinations of quirks, gifts, and style that you have. The only one. And what a loss it would be to the world and to you if you never put the mask down long enough to find the actor inside and bring him and her up to full size too. What a shame it would be if we focused so hard on the roles we have to play that when we reach the end, we realize that it slipped through our fingers. The audience that matters most deeply to all of us hopes that you will do it, because they want you to be the hero of your unique story. And if you haven't found the audience that wants you to be the hero, you haven't found the right audience. You don't want to waste your A game on B audiences. At its best, this church is one of those better audiences that will prefer the actor to the characters. I try to preach from and to those places that listen for the better angels of our nature, that help us find the Buddha seed, the God seed that's within us. Because I don't want, and you don't want, life to slip through your fingers. You want life all over your fingers, all over your body, soaked deep into your mind and warming the very depths of your heart. You want this so that when the person whose opinion means the most asks, "Were you true to your best self? Were you animated by love rather than envy or hate? By compassion rather than condescension? By understanding rather than prejudice?" And the other questions that will come up on that sort of existential exam. You want to be able to raise your head and say, "Yes. Yes. I was not perfect, but I tried as well as I knew how to be a person of integrity and character, and to be a small blessing to the people whose lives I touched as I passed through. I tried to make and to be a positive difference to the very best of my ability. And you know what? It was sufficient. It was enough." The applause won't come from outside. It will come from the opinion that is finally the most important opinion in your world. It will come from inside, because it's the opinion of the better angels of your nature that you most want to play to. And the noise from that silent applause can be deafening.